All right, at this time, we'll let the musicians go down while you're turning in your Bibles to Genesis 25. All right, out of respect for the Word of God, let's stand together as I begin reading with verse 24. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, all over like an hairy garment. And they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Esau was 80 years old when she bare them.
Thank you, Brother Chandler. It's good to have Brother Chandler's voice back. Now, last week we said goodbye and farewell to Abraham, the friend of God and the father of the faithful. He died at age 175, a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. He was buried with Sarah, his beloved wife, and Isaac and Ishmael were together for the last time at their father's funeral. Now, there's a transition in chapter 25, and it's marked by the word generations. We've seen this word throughout the book of Genesis. In fact, the word Genesis comes from these generations throughout the book. And we've seen it in relation to the heavens and the earth, in relation to Adam and Noah, the sons of Noah, Shem, Terah, and Abraham. And each time we see the word generations, it's showing us that God is narrowing it down, that lineage of Jesus Christ. Of course, we all began with Adam, and then from Adam through to Noah, and then you have the sons of Noah. But it shows particularly the family of Shem, and then Terah, and then Abraham. In verse 12, it says, "Now these are the generations of Ishmael," and God gives us his generations, but it's a dead end alley. It's a blind alley, because he's just going to tell us about them, and then we're going to leave them throughout the rest of the Bible. And follow the lineage of Isaac in verse 19. "And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac." And so from here on, the focus is on Isaac and then on his son Jacob. As we follow this lineage, these generations are going to lead us to the Lord Jesus Christ, who is of the family of Abraham and the family of Isaac and the family of Jacob and Judah and David. And as we've seen this throughout the book of Genesis. Now, for the next few chapters, we're going to be studying the life of Isaac and his family. Now, in the narrative, Abraham is dead by verse 8, but chronologically, he lived all the way until Isaac was 75, and the twins were 15. And so further on in the story, Abraham is still around, but he's not mentioned and he's not part of the narrative as God has given us. But it is encouraging to know that he got to see his grandsons and experience them and enjoy them all the way up into their teenage years. Now, the family of Isaac is an interesting family. And we've already seen how Isaac and Rebekah came together as husband and wife. And now we're going to see what happens next as children come into their life. And one thing we're seeing in Genesis, there's more family truth in Genesis than any other book of the Bible. More family narrative, more family history, more family incidents than any other book of the Bible, because God is teaching us some lessons about family as found here, especially in Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph later on. Now, notice first Isaac's entreaty in verse 20. Now, let me ask a question. How long was it between Isaac and Rebekah's marriage and the birth of the twins? Well, notice in verse 20. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife. And now verse 26 at the very end, it says, "And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them." All right, I had public school math, but I think that's 20 years, right? 20 years from the time they got married. He was 40. We don't know how old Rebekah was. Probably much younger. From the time that he was 40, and then the twins were born when he was 60. And so 20 years have passed between marriage and the birth of the twins. Now, one thought here is that having children, when we want to have children, is not a given in life. It's not a given in life. Even if you want to have children, it's not a given that you will or that you'll have them when you want to. It's not a given. We take some things for granted because most people who want to have kids can have kids, we just assume, it never even crosses our mind, that maybe we will not. And we should not take some things for granted. If you have children, you should thank God that you have children. You really should. And what a blessing that is. And historically, you and I are very fortunate to live in this time that we live in. I don't want to bore you with my ancient history all the time, but I have been reading a lot of historical biographies of the presidents. In fact, if you don't find the books interesting, I also have a bobblehead collection in my office that some of you might find more interesting. When I read a biography, then I buy these presidential bobbleheads to match the biography that I have read. And they're nice bobbleheads. And now my father is collecting them also, and he's competing with me. And but anyhow, one thing that has amazed me in the colonial times was the infant mortality rate. All of the founding fathers outlived at least one or more of their children. George Washington had no natural children, but his wife, Martha, who was a widow, had four or five children. They outlived all of her kids. They all died, either in childhood birth or a young adulthood. In colonial times, 40% of children did not live past age 20. 4 out of 10. Folks, we live in an ugly world. And we should not take some things for granted. To have children is a blessing. For to outlive, for your children to outlive you is also a blessing in this ugly, sin-cursed world we live in. But we should never take it for granted that just because we want to have children, we can have children. Here, 20 years have passed, and they've not had any kids. Now, if children are not given, sometimes it's very hard to trust God with that. And in fact, I've known people that it kind of wrecked their faith. That they wanted so badly to have children, and they didn't have any children. And they had such a struggle trusting God with that fact, they became bitter about it and resentful toward the fact that they wanted kids and God wouldn't let them have kids. And here these other lousy human beings out there have all the kids they want. Some don't even want the kids they have. They get bitter about it. I remember hearing a preacher tell about his own testimony. He and his wife years couldn't have children. And one day they're visiting out in the sticks, somewhere in Indiana. This is just a shack these people were living in. They went out to visit these folks, and the children just walking around dirty and uncared for, and diapers unchanged, and their faces are filthy, and the house was a mess, and it's obvious the parents didn't care. And the pastor's wife sat there and she looked around at all that filth, and she started getting bitter towards God that God would let these people have children, but God wouldn't let her have children. For several years she struggled with that bitterness until she finally turned it over to the Lord. By the way, God ended up giving them 7 children. Later on, they went to a pastor and asked him to anoint them with oil, which is something in the Bible. And he anointed them with oil. They ended up having 7 kids. He always said after that, I knew I used too much oil. But I'm saying that that kind of bitterness can get in when we're not willing to trust God with that. You know, it could be that God withholds children for the protection of the wife. We're going to get to Rachel later, but Rachel, Jacob's wife, she wanted to have kids so badly. She was so competitive with her sister. Her sister's having kid after kid after kid. She had like half a dozen kids, and Rachel still hasn't had any. Well, then we read later that she finally had Joseph, and then much later after that, she died giving birth to Benjamin. And it could be that if God had let her get pregnant before that, they would have missed out on years of marriage together. Because constitutionally, God knew that she could not bear children without great risk to her own life and health. I'm not trying to come up with all the answers. I'm just trying to point out some things in the Bible. That things are not a given, and things are dangerous, and things don't always go the way we want to. And when we have those things, we should really be grateful for them. But having children is not an automatic given in life. But I got news for you, folks. God has to be in charge of some things, including life and death. God has to be in charge of these things. And who are you and I to tell God how to run the universe? If God withholds, then God is right to withhold. If God gives, God is right to give. And we've got to learn to trust Him. And I know that's easy to say and hard to live, but nevertheless, that's just the truth that I see here. 20 years. Remember when Rebecca went off to marry Isaac? the blessing that her family put upon her. Be thou the mother of thousands of millions. And yet 20 years, no children. And I'm getting ahead of myself, but you know, it's interesting that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all fell in love with women that were extremely beautiful, but had a hard time bearing children. Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel all had movie star looks. They were gorgeous. We can see the problems that Sarah and Rebecca had when they went to the among these foreign people because they all wanted her. We saw that in Egypt. We saw that in the Philistines. We'll see that again with the Philistines. And Rachel was said to have been extremely beautiful, and yet they all had difficulty in conceiving and having children. Sarah didn't have Isaac till she was 90. Rebecca, 20 years after marriage. And we've already discussed how Rachel had difficulty finally conceiving and bearing Joseph, and then died giving birth to Benjamin. It's interesting to me that the patriarchs had such small families, and each of them had trouble in this regard. Now there's Ishmael, he's got 12. And Esau, he's going to have a big family. He's got multiple wives too. But I mean, and yet the patriarchs are having these a family of one kid, two kids, and difficulty with all of them. Now, I said all that to say this, that of the three patriarchs that we're going to discuss, only Isaac did the right thing in this regard. When Abraham and Sarah wanted to have a child, and all those years passed and they couldn't have a child, what was their solution? Trust God? Pray? No, here's Hagar, take her. Have a child by her. A heathen. We're to discuss that. Years later, when Jacob and Rachel, when Rachel wants to have a child, what's her solution? Here's my handmaid. Take her. Have children by her. A heathen practice. You see, Abraham yielded to Sarah's suggestion, and he made a foolish decision. And Jacob ended up with four wives, three too many. And only Isaac, the one in the middle, was wise enough to say, I don't need another woman. I need to pray to God about this. You see. And he, all the patriarchs, is the one that made the right decision. In this one area, Isaac was wiser than his father. Now, in some areas, Abraham was wiser than Isaac, but in this area, Isaac was wiser than his father. They weren't having kids. He went to the Lord and prayed to the Lord. He didn't go find another woman. He went to God about it. By the way, you and I should go to God about things. Instead of stooping to ulterior motives and sinful methods, why don't we learn to trust God and go to Him and spend time in prayer about some things? Now, in verse 21, it says, Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife. This is the first time the word entreat is used in the Bible. It means to ask on behalf of someone else or pray on behalf of someone else. It is the same as intercede. To intercede for someone, to entreat the Lord for his wife. He wasn't really even praying for himself as much as he was praying for her, because I know Isaac loved his wife. We saw that at the end of chapter 24. And there's nothing that I find in the Bible that tells me that love ever disappeared. He loved his wife. And he knew that it was heavy on her heart that she wanted to be a mother, and she wanted to enjoy that and have those children, and was not able to have these. He knew this was a sort of great pain for her. And when I was a young person, I didn't understand this, but now, as a middle-aged person who's pastored a few people, I can say that there's hardly, I haven't seen anything that has weighed as heavy on people's hearts as the inability to have children. That I've seen that really burden people and break their hearts and trouble their faith or to see ladies have multiple miscarriages, not able to bring a child to birth, and it's such a heartache and such a terrible pain that they deal with in that sort of situation. It's heartbreaking. And I just know that Isaac, he's so concerned for his wife, and so he's praying on her behalf. Now, I used to read verse 21 and I would say, now why did Isaac wait 20 years to pray? But the Bible doesn't say that he waited 20 years to pray. It says that Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and then there's a colon. And the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Now, that doesn't say that he waited 20 years and then prayed. It just said that he prayed, and then there's a pause, and then it says the Lord was entreated of him. It wouldn't be the first time in the Bible that someone prayed And then years later, God gave the answer. And I have a feeling that Isaac probably started praying years before, maybe 15 years before. 5 years, I'm going to start praying to the Lord. Maybe 10 years, maybe 15 years before. And now God, in His own timing, God has His own timing, doesn't He? Sometimes we walk by faith, sometimes we wait by faith. And so, he has prayed, he has entreated the Lord, and what does this teach us? That if you're praying for something, you keep on praying for it. You keep on praying for it. Remember Zacharias and Elizabeth, John the Baptist's mom and dad? Dad and mom? Thy prayer is heard. I'm sure Zacharias is thinking, man, I prayed that years ago. I've kind of given up on having kids. Didn't matter. God had heard that prayer, and God in His own time is going to send them a son, you see. And so he entreated the Lord. The Lord was entreated of him, and she conceived. Now, what should a couple do when they want to have children but do not seem able? Well, I'll give my thoughts on this from the Bible. Number one, do as the Lord and pray. Or do as Isaac did and pray. Parents ought to pray that God will give them children, give them healthy children. Secondly, wait upon the Lord. Just because a couple doesn't have a child in the first 5 years doesn't mean God's never going to give them a child. My parents were married for about 9 years before they were blessed with me. So, 9 years. Almost killed my mom. Delivered by C-section back then. And boy, rushing her to the hospital. And my dad told me, you know, he'll never forget her being wheeled down the hallway of the hospital, leaving a trail of blood behind. 9 years. But I was worth the wait. So wait upon the Lord. And by the way, many other people, doctors even said, you'll never have kids. And years passed, and guess what? God gave children. I believe people ought to seek medical help. And I also believe that it's possible that God intends some couples to adopt. And I think that if God had not given us children, that I would have been interested in adopting. Although I realize that these days, that's much more complicated than it used to be. But I still think that is a worthy thing. If God has not given people children, perhaps He intends for them to adopt children and give them a home. But it may come to a point where we just have to say, you know what, God's God, and I got to put things in His hands. And if for whatever reason He does not give me a child, then I just have to learn to trust Him with that. In any case, Isaac's prayer resulted in a conception. So notice, secondly, Rebekah's inquiry in verse 22. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. Now, I want to point out that first that it says, the children struggled. Not the fetuses. Not extra cells. Not tissuey mass. The Bible never refers to that as a fetus. You know, like you used to work on in biology class with a pig fetus. You need to say, that's not a human. A human being becomes a life at conception. It's not just something you throw away. That's a human being. And if that child has, his life begins somewhere, and it must begin at conception. It says she conceived, and then it says the children. Where did that happen? Conception. Life begins at conception. And it's amazing that Christians will not understand or accept that fact. That is not a baby just because it's been around for the first trimester or the second trimester or the third trimester. Hey, let me ask you a question. When is it okay to kill the baby? When is it okay to kill a baby? Amen. How about a day after birth? Or what about a day before birth? How about a month after birth? What about a month before birth? Do you know that there are some abortion advocates now? This was in a medical journal back in 2012, calling for the opportunity to end a child's life up to a month after they're born. Well, what is it? Is it a child or not? Well, if it's a child after birth, what's it a child a day before birth? Is it a child before birth? A day before, a month before, 3 months before, 9 months before? When does it become a child? That human life begins somewhere. As far as I'm concerned, the only consistent position that a Christian should take is that life begins at conception, and that life ought to be protected. And to end that life before birth is to commit is to shed innocent blood. It's sin. It's wrong. If I'm disappointed in anything right now in politics, is the inability to defund Planned Parenthood and to pass laws and to deal with this terrible ethical destruction of abortion in our country. There's a lot of political topics, but that's my number one right now. I don't think it's number one for a lot of people. And it just shows us Satan is a murderer. He's behind all of it. And the abortion racket is a major force in our country. Christians need to understand what the Bible teaches. So she conceived, and then it says, and the children struggled together within her. Now, it's always an exciting thing, even though it's been a long time. I still remember when you feel those first kicks and your wife says, hey, put your hand right here. And you feel that, boom, kick on the side. It's like, whoa. You can be a soccer player, you know. You can be a football player. You feel that kick and you feel the movement. Of course, back in Bible times, you couldn't go down and see the sonograms and hear the things they can see now. I mean, the sonograms now sometimes are so technologically advanced. They can basically show you the child's entire face. When our kids are small, you just saw this like a sonar thing, and they told you that as a kid in there somewhere. So that first kick is something, but boy, this is different. The children struggling within her. It was like someone had set up a steel cage and there was a no disqualification match going on in there. The Von Erichs and the Freebirds going at it or something. Because that Hebrew word there means to crack in pieces. It's a very strong Hebrew word. So it's used here, and then it's used other places for oppressed or break his skull. It's the same term. To crush. I mean, this is not the usual kicking and moving around. I mean, these babies are struggling within her, and she's wondering, what in the world is going on? I was wondering, you know, back then, back before all the technology we have now, how did they always know it was twins? Did they know it was twins? And so I did a lot of research, went to the library and pulled out old books. Okay, I Googled it. And went to this one site where people, you know, they had the question at the Quora or something. He went to he had the question, then people put their answers down. And it was the same question I asked. How did they know it was twins before all the technology and stuff? And I read this one. It was interesting. This person wrote, my grandmother was expecting her second child in late 1959. The midwife felt around and told her that she was expecting a big boy. She could hear one healthy heartbeat. My grandmother used to complain at the strength of the kicks, telling my grandfather, this baby's got 4 feet and hobnail boots on. 4 feet and boots on. The baby did have 4 feet because it was twins. And the reason there was only one heartbeat is they were synchronized. Isn't that amazing? Kick, 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 kick. And so, I mean, she's feeling the baby struggling. I mean, Esau's got Jacob in a headlock, and Jacob's putting him in a Boston crab. I mean, it's a struggle. Very unusual. Probably keeping her up day and night. And so she said, well, if it be so, why am I thus? If this is from God, why am I feeling like this? What's going on? And notice she went to inquire of the Lord. Now, that's not a throwaway line. This is important. But here's a woman that had a concern, had a question. She went to God and asked, and God answered her. And that's amazing that it wasn't just Isaac that could get his prayers answered. It wasn't just the patriarchs that could get their prayers answered. But Rebecca, when she had a concern, had a question, had a need, she went to the Lord and inquired of Him. And her voice went right to God's ear, and God answered her. Isn't that amazing? Well, I need the preacher to pray. You can pray too. You can go to the Lord and ask. I wouldn't expect a verbal answer from the sky, but God might direct you into the Word, or might tell the preacher to say something in the next message or something. But if you ask God, I don't think God will ignore your questions. And so she went to inquire, and God gave her an answer. In fact, we find here, thirdly, God's revelation. God answered her directly in verse 23. The Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now, here's an important truth also. Not only were there two children in her womb, there were two nations in her womb. I get that. Let that sink in. He said, two nations are in thy womb. In other words, God not only counted the two babies in the womb, He counted their potential. The potential of their lives. And He saw in them not only Esau and Jacob, but the Edomites and the Israelites. You see, two nations. The potential of those human lives. That's why abortion, again, is such a terrible crime. It doesn't just stop a beating heart. It cuts off a potential that only God knows. Only God knows. Well, you know, what if they grow up to be evil? You mean like Esau? Are you and I going to be, we're the judges of that? God is the one who has to be in charge of stuff like that. We have to realize. I mean, I just wonder. You think about babies that have been murdered since Roe v. Wade came out. How many of those would be grandparents today? What lineages, what children might, what potential was destroyed, thrown out like trash? So God says, I see two nations are in thy womb. And it says, two manner of people should be separated from thy bowels. And one people should be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now here are two brothers. You can't get any closer than this. Two brothers, same parents, twins. Yet they're going to be totally different from each other. Totally different from each other. People say, well, when I have kids, my kids are going to be like this. You have no idea what your kids are going to be like. You have no idea. Well, my kids will all be the same. Maybe not. Maybe not. You see, within the human being, there is a tremendous range of being, isn't there? Esau was going to grow up to be a carnal man, no interest in the things of God whatsoever. His family is going to be an ungodly family. Jacob's going to grow up to be a trickster, but he's going to have some inclination towards God, and eventually he's going to come back to God. And there's no telling what our kids will be like. That's why we need to pray for them and train them and disciple them and teach them and help them. But man, I don't even know if I have fully grasped this thought of these two manners of people from the same womb. But haven't we seen this before? Huh? Cain and Abel? Two brothers, same parents, same household, can't even blame the public school system. One's a murderer and one's a martyr. So God already called it from the very beginning, before they were born. And so there'll be separated two manner of people, two different ways of living, two different nations will come of this. And He said that the elder will serve the younger. Now, if they had believed that, it would have saved a lot of trouble. Wouldn't have had to have the birthright problem and the stealing of the blessing. If they just accepted what God had already told them, that the elder would serve the younger, then they would have understood that God always intended that Esau was not going to be the chosen seed, that it would be the younger. Jacob would be the younger by about a minute, but still the younger of the two. Now, let's finish with the birth of the twins in verse 24 through 26. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that, his brother came out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. Now, these boys are fraternal twins. That means they're not identical twins. And they're about as far from identical as two boys could be. Now, Esau was born first, and he was a deep red color. He was covered with hair. He was born with a beard. The doctor did not slap him. Esau slapped the doctor. I mean, he was born walking and talking. He was a man-child. Well, Jacob, his description is not given here, but he's called later a smooth man in comparison to his hairy brother. And I read this recently. Now, I'm sure perhaps the Darts know about this, having had twins. But recent studies have brought to light a condition that afflicts twins in the womb. which many Christian doctors thinks is seen here with Esau and Jacob, is called twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, TTTS. Twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. It can cause one twin to receive more blood flow than the other. See, now that explains Michael, you see. But anyway, I'm just waking Michael up over there. But it causes one twin to receive more blood flow than the other. The baby receiving less blood is naturally going to be to have a more retarded growth, while the other twin... This is not supposed to be funny. I'm sorry I made fun of Michael. And this is the term used in the medical thing that I read. More retarded growth, while the other twin can become abnormally developed or ultra-developed. Most of the time, it proves fatal to one or both of the babies. In other words, this is something that can cause one of the babies to be stillborn or to die in the womb or could kill both. When both are delivered, one is unusually red because of all that extra blood that he's been receiving, while the other is very pale and anemic. And some believe this explains the significant difference between red Esau and his heel-grabbing little brother, Jacob. Jacob, getting all that extra blood, a little more developed and was red, while Jacob, though it's not described here, he does seem to perhaps have been a little more sickly, smaller than his big, hairy brother. Okay? And so I found that very interesting that their description, one was red and the other obviously was not, there would have been no distinction. And it's possible that that was the reason why. Now, the midwife did notice something else amazing at the birth, and that is when Esau was born, he was born with a little hand holding his heel. Holding his heel. I'm not done with you yet. Get back here. Holding his heel. And so they named Esau, Esau, because it means red. It's the most distinguishing factor or feature. While Jacob, they named Jacob, which means heel grabber or supplanter, one who takes the place of another. You're about to get ahead, but he reaches back and pulls you back and passes you. That's a supplanter. And that's what the name Jacob means. And by the way, that's what the word James means also, because it's a derivative of Jacob, for those who might find that interesting. And so Jacob, he's going to grow up to be that supplanter. One day he's going to buy the birthright. He's going to steal the blessing. And he's going to take that firstborn's place, even though he was born after his older brother.